You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Hello and welcome to today's lunchtime event. I'm Jonathan Rowson. I'm director of the Social Brain Centre at the RSA here. And it's a great pleasure to welcome you all to what is a relatively unusual event for us. You may know the RSA is a place of sort of bastion of ideas, churning out ideas in paper, visual, animated form for many years, quite successfully and quite, you know, joyously in a way. We sort of love ideas here. So today's event is a kind of stock check of that at one level, but it's also just pursuing it a little bit further and trying to understand more deeply partly what we're doing here, but also the limitations of that. It's a great pleasure to welcome Robert Roland Smith, who is a writer and philosopher, among various other things. I've known Robert through various professional capacities the last couple of years. He actually spoke at our opening event on spirituality about, I'm guessing, almost 2 years ago now, that was led to this report called Spiritualize, which is where I first got interested in the idea of what it means to go beyond ideas and the limitations of the purely cognitive form of inquiry to the world. Robert will map out the territory in more detail and what this event is about. So without further ado, welcome Robert Roland Smith.
Thanks very much indeed. One way into this, and there are a number of ways into this, is through what Jonathan just mentioned there. So the RSA was running this project on spirituality, and I had a very small part in that. And I'm no expert at all on spirituality, but one of the things that struck me as we were doing some work around that project is the relationship between spirituality and ideas. Now, I'm a philosopher by training and by background, so ideas are my stock in trade. I've worked for years on ideas and the history of ideas, mainly philosophical ideas from the history of German, French, continental philosophy, and also ideas from the world of psychoanalysis and so on. So when it comes to kind of talking about ideas and ideas of how ideas have progressed through history, I spent quite a lot of my kind of professional time involved in that. But when it came to the question of spirituality, I wondered how far ideas could actually help us. And I guess the first thought there was, well, if there is such a thing in spirituality as the soul, and I stress the word if there is such a thing as the soul, then I really wonder what use ideas would be to it. What would the soul need from ideas? Ideas seem to me a particularly cognitive, obviously ideational set of phenomena, thoughts, and these wouldn't necessarily help us to grow or develop or mature our souls in any way. And I suppose that was the first kind of juncture at which I begin to feel a certain limitation in the notion of ideas. And I think the thought behind that was, well, ideas almost by definition aren't real. Ideas aren't reality. They take place in our heads. They are, by their nature, somewhat detached from reality. They have the quality of speculation. They tend to be more about the future, they're speculative in that sense, or about they're about possibilities that might have happened from the past. So to that extent, ideas and reality aren't connected, and I think it would be the case that if there is such a thing as the soul, it would be much more interested in the real than in the idea-based world. So I guess this was the first thought, that ideas are somehow not connected to reality, and if I wanted to be particularly provocative about it, I'd say in that respect, ideas are actually cousins of the lie, because they are not grounded in the real. They are somehow fictional or detached from what's real. It's, when we talk about an idea, we're not reporting on fact. We're reporting on something that's whose relationship to fact is somewhat tenuous. So, as I say, it's somewhat a kind of heretical set of thoughts for me to have as a philosopher by trade. But this set of thoughts, I think, connected with another set of practices that I guess I've been involved in, because alongside my writing work and thinking work and so on, I'm involved in a kind of, I guess, broadly psychotherapeutic practice that some of you may have heard of called Constellations, which involves working with dynamics in groups. So it's a tiny bit like group therapy, I guess, but the idea is you're exposing hidden dynamics in groups and systems and so on. And that work can't function unless we actually turn our ideas off, because ideas get in the way. The trouble with ideas is they obscure our relationship to reality sometimes. And by obscuring that relationship to reality, they inhibit our grasp of what's before us. So I'm going to give you a couple of illustrations of this by way of talking about, first of all, different ways of seeing. And secondly, I want to talk about a word I've coined, really, which is the idea of the solus, S-O-L-U-S, which is about our creative principle and how I believe our creative principle is not rooted in ideas but in something else. So first of all, on this notion of seeing. Now, it seems to me there are four ways for us of seeing the world. And the most dominant one is an ideas-based way of seeing the world. And my nickname for it is Google Glasses. So some of you will be familiar with Google Glasses, or the idea at least of Google Glasses. You wear a pair of glasses, and up on the kind of screen in front of you come lots of bytes of information that you can use to decode the world around you. So it provides a filter. It's a little bit like if you're walking down the street and you're trying to find your way to a party or something, and you're looking at Google Maps on your phone. You're not really looking at the street, you're looking at your phone. Or if you think about tourists going to visit monuments around the world, you'll often see tourists looking at the monument primarily through their lens, their iPhone lens or their camera lens, rather than looking at the object itself. So it's kind of a mediated environment. We're looking through a lens at the world rather than looking at the world directly. And I say this is ideas-based because what we then tend to look at the world with is an idea of it rather than the reality. And I'll give you an example of this from the world of psychotherapy, which I'm a little bit involved in. It seems to me that in relationships, particularly couple relationships, but not just couple relationships, what tends to make them go wrong is when each partner has an idea of the other partner rather than being able to see the reality of the other partner, and that becomes intolerable. So, for example, if my partner has the idea that I'm lazy, although it might be true some of the time, the fact she holds that as an idea of me all of the time becomes intolerable, and therefore she sees every action that I do through the lens of that laziness, rather than giving me a break sometimes, you know, when in fact I haven't been lazy or I've been ill, for example. Or say you run a business and there's somebody in your business or somebody you work with who you think of as a bit of a slacker. And so one day they turn up at work and they're late again, and you think, yeah, well, of course they're late again because they're a bit of a slacker. I've got an idea about this person, I've got a theory about them, and my idea of them has been confirmed through the behaviour that I've seen. What's actually happened is that this person has been helping a cyclist who's been knocked over on the street outside the office. They've been delayed, not only not through no fault of their own, but because another part of them, a much kinder, more caring part of them, has helped this other person. But I don't see that. It's out of view. What I see is my idea of this person as being a bit of a slacker, and that idea is a kind of filter through which I see them, and it limits my grasp of the reality of what's going on. And this kind of Google Glasses approach to the world, I think, is pretty ubiquitous. So we tend to see the world through our idea of it rather than through what it is. And that's one way, I guess, in which kind of ideas, or the most perhaps a very common way at least, in which ideas get in the way of our ability to experience what could be called the phenomenological world. I use the word phenomenological just to introduce a tiny bit of philosophical terminology here, in contrast with the hermeneutic. So when we have our Google Glasses on, when we see the world most of the time, we're working hermeneutically, i.e. we're working interpretatively. We're trying to interpret the world around us because there's so much to see and experience. And that reduces the world into something manageable, as opposed to working phenomenologically, where we're not reducing the world to ideas and thoughts, we're just experiencing it. Because it's much harder for us as human beings, generally speaking, simply to experience the world than to interpret it. Because interpretation provides a smaller package. It bundles up the world into bites that we can then cope with and digest. So as human beings, we tend to prefer a hermeneutic, interpretative approach to the world than a phenomenological one. But I think that's a loss. And if I talk about other ways of seeing, I think we can see some of the benefits that come once we kind of wean ourselves off this filtered, mediated, idea-based way of looking at the world. So that's the first way. There are four altogether. So there's kind of Google Glasses way of looking at the world, which I think is the most common, and we all do it all of the time. The second one is what could be called a much purer way of seeing the world, and it's a kind of data view. It's unadorned. There are no interpretations whatsoever. There's a famous tool in the world of management consultancy and organization development that some of you may know called the ladder of inference. And what it says is we all need to use much less interpretation of what goes on around us and just stick to the facts. So let's just report what we see in front of us. Just simply describe what's in front of us rather than trying to add anything to it. And I'm always struck when thinking about this by an anecdote about James Joyce, the modernist author writing roughly 100 years ago, when he taught writing classes in Trieste in Italy, where he was living at the time. And instead of asking his students to produce florid poetry or beautifully literary descriptions of the world or tell very embellished stories, he simply asked them to note down what was in the room. They simply had to list stuff, furniture, you know, desks, tables, glasses of water, ceiling fittings, door jams, dado rails, cornices, whatever it might be, in the room. And, of course, it turns out that that's very hard for people to do because, you know, our instinct is always to add more than is necessary. And the effort of seeing can be a very hard effort altogether. And yet, of course, it's the basis, really, of good noticing. And to that extent, you know, good fact is really the origin of excellent fiction. You know, it's a clarity of view, but one that we can only begin to get to once we lose some of our idea clutter, our ideational clutter, to use a more technical term. And that's, I think, a kind of second level in which we begin to move beyond ideas and experience the world a little more what I would call phenomenologically or inclusively, if you prefer that word. Then I think there are two other ways of seeing which are rarer, but I think equally useful and helpful to us as human beings if we want to kind of make the most of the kind of gift of being alive and all the faculties we have. And the third mode of seeing, I use the word hazing for. So hazing, when things go hazy or slightly out of focus. Now, I don't know if you've ever had this experience. I think it happens from time to time when you're in a conversation or you're at a party or an event. And you begin to understand the whole a little bit better precisely because you lose focus on it. Like the contours blur, things become a little bit softer, but your understanding increases. And it increases precisely because you're not seeing so much sharpness of detail. And what emerges is a kind of more impressionistic picture that allows you to feel what's going on. And again, you're shifting from an idea space to a more, even more physical space, a more chromatic space, a more deeply intuitive space that includes more of the ambient environment in which you're working or being, but doesn't turn it over into kind of sharp fact and doesn't produce ideas around it. So you're beginning to understand what's going on. If you think, for example, of it's a little bit like seeing things in hindsight. You know, sometimes you'll have been in a difficult conversation, it might have been confusing or awkward for you, and only later, you know, that night, the middle of the night or in the morning, you suddenly kind of understand what was going on. It's that sense of seeing things in the round, you know, now you get it. It's not because you understand any particular detail, but you have an awareness that was not accessible to you when you were seeing things in other modes, if you like. And again, what's important about this level of seeing, I think, is that it takes us away from an idea space into something a bit more holistic or inclusive. And the fourth way of seeing, I'll just touch on before giving a very different example, is what I would call a meta way of seeing. So occasionally we have a sense of our, we'll be in a situation, it could be work situation, personal situation, social situation, where we, as it were, rise above the chessboard and we see ourselves as one of the players on the chessboard itself. Most of our lives we're just on the chessboard, effectively. And our view is obscured. It's a bit like being in a church and not being able to see through because of all the pillars in the way. Most of our experience in life is like that. We're kind of on the chessboard with everybody else. But occasionally we do get the opportunity, sometimes it happens completely by chance, and it's, I think, probably quite rare, where we see ourselves as part of the scene in which we are taking part. And at that level, we are not, again, seeing ideas at all, but what we're appreciating is not only the whole, but our place in the whole. And this equips us to understand the world, again, more roundly or more broadly than we normally can. And it spares us from the anxiety of producing ideas about the world or interpreting the world. So this move away from ideas, as I say, began with me, first of all, in this project around spirituality here at the RSA, but then began to connect up with the work I was doing anyway in constellations and other forms of non-cognitive, non-ideational inquiry. And I began to see it mapped out particularly in kind of ordinary experiences of seeing and how different they are. If you see how you see, if you notice how you notice the world and the different qualities to it, you can understand how ideas aren't always the way in which you do see the world or have to see the world, and that the ideas-based approach of seeing the world, this hermeneutic, interpretative way, though helpful in terms of making sense of what's going on, is also somewhat limiting. And I just want to add another example or two, just to try and illustrate what is, after all, a rather abstract subject. By talking about a couple of examples of working with creativity. So I'm a writer, but I also work a lot with artists and photographers, dancers and so on, people in the creative world to try and help them with their creativity when they got blocked and so on. And one thing I've noticed is that artists from all different media will come and say, you know, I've run out of ideas, or, you know, I need a new idea. What's the big new idea? You know, I'm stuck because I need an idea. And it's as if they believe the idea is the thing that can unlock the world for them. But in my experience of working with them, in constellations and in other forms, it's not actually the idea that is the answer. It's often the idea that is the problem, because they have an idea of an idea. They have an idea that their idea is going to come and rescue them. There's going to be the big thing. If only I had the big idea. Yeah, and everything would follow. I mean, you can think about this in a political environment, if you like, a policy environment indeed, which is perhaps slightly more close to the kind of mainstream work here at the RSA. If you think about, Labour at the last election or the Conservatives at the previous election, you know, the Conservatives were desperate for a big idea, and the big idea at the time was the big society. So it was a big idea. Labour didn't seem to be able to produce, or at least hit upon, or communicate at least, such a clear big idea. And it was the absence of a big idea, or the strain to find one, that seemed to create a lot of tension and lose energy, lose enthusiasm for people around them. So there's often this sense that the big idea is the big answer. But in the world of creativity, it seems to me that it's not an idea that matters, because an idea tends to operate, as I say, as a kind of figment or speculative frame in the mind and has lost some contact with physical reality. And what seems to work better in the creative space is when people identify what I call, this is my own word, perhaps a rather peculiar word, which is what I call the solus, S-O-L-U-S, S-O-L-U-S, the solus. The word is, it's solus because it suggests what's solitary and what's unique. Because what matters about tapping into creativity in this move away from ideas is that we move away from other people. There's something separating about it. We have to follow a path that is not that of anybody else. We mustn't allow our fate to become entangled with that of others. Now, it's particularly common in artists because they become very influenced by previous masters in different media. So it's hard for them to break out of that influence and establish their own voice. They suffer from what Harold Bloom, a literary critic, called the anxiety of influence. And it's almost literally like a kind of influenza. You know, you get a cold from the past because you can't shake off the influence of people who've influenced you. And it's very important, it seems to me, that that you get rid of that idea of the previous person who's influenced you, partly because it's limiting and it stops you being yourself, but partly because it is an idea. You have an idea, a kind of fantasy, essentially, of what that previous person did that you ought to be copying or following in some way. And yet what's most helpful for people in creative spaces, it seems to me, is when they wean themselves off that idea altogether and recognise how solitary the path of creativity has to be and how non-ideas-based it has to be if they're going to locate what I call this solus, which I would describe as the principle of creative energy that we all have within us. But we have it within us and get distracted from it because we go looking for an idea rather than its sources in ourselves, or its source in ourselves. And the solus is most clearly recognised when we think about those things which return to us again and again, the things which bug us, the things that come up in our dreams, the images we can't shake, the repeated phrases, pictures, sounds, images which crop up again and again in our thinking. When we go back and log the kind of deeper stuff that's coming from our unconscious without us being able to filter it, then we are able to start to get at what I call the solus, which is a kind of creative principle or creative energy within all of us. But we have to allow ourselves to become as peculiar as we all are, as we all are rather peculiar. And the peculiarity lies in the uniqueness of our dreams, our history, the attraction or appeal we have for certain images or words that are very odd to us, and we might even feel a little bit about ashamed of our relationship to them, but are defining in some way. And it's only by giving ourselves over to that particular idiom that we begin to find our solace. If you think about, if you think of two particularly idiomatic painters, think of Picasso, for example, or Francis Bacon, you know, what is so compelling about those painters, I think, is precisely this, that there is an obsession with the singularity that's only theirs. That there is no, even though, you know, Bacon will refer back to Velázquez, Picasso will refer back to Delacroix and so on, even though they're fully conscious of their inheritors, they're not suffering from the anxiety of influence. They've shuffled off those influences, made them their own, because they have the courage or the audacity, if you like, to embrace what's completely unique in their unconscious and what's peculiar in their unconscious. So Francis Bacon, for example, became obsessed with dentists' pictures of mouth decay, tooth decay. You know, odd, obsessive, nasty thing to be obsessed to become preoccupied with. But it became a kind of creative spring for him that influenced particularly his early works and right into his late works, in fact. And that wasn't an idea of something, it was a compulsion. And a compulsion comes from a different place from an idea. A compulsion is much more visceral, it's much darker, comes from a different source in ourselves, not from an idea like, oh, I'm going to, you know, I've got an idea for doing this, I've got an idea for doing that. It's more like, if it is an idea, it's more like the idea has us than we have the idea. It comes to us, it overtakes us, it calls us, and we then have to submit to it. It's that way round. Rather than this notion of having ideas, which is a very common kind of 21st century notion. You know, We talk about having ideas as though we can consume them or produce them or as though we own them. Whereas in fact, the best ideas, you know, if ideas are valuable, are those that come at us, if you like, aren't ours in some way, come from within without us anticipating them. And then the final example, and I'll stop on this one, is a similar, is very related notion of what I call perdition. So perdition is a very old-fashioned word, P-E-R-D-I-T-I-O-N, perdition. It means literally being lost. It's a kind of archaic word, people don't use it much now. But I think it marks out a similar process. That when we look for ideas, it's as if we're looking for navigation in the world. We're looking for a kind of weather vane to show us where to go. And it seems to me that's exactly the opposite of what we should be doing if we want to be creative or produce new, original, exciting work. It's precisely the getting lost that seems to be the place in which we find our most innovative kind of sources, if you like. And I always think here in relation to of an essay by Walter Benjamin, the kind of cultural theorist, I guess you'd call him, also more or less a contemporary of James Joyce, as it happens, who has an essay about travel. And he says, the only way to travel is to get lost. And so he'd be completely despairing, a kind of modern-day travel guide, you know, which makes you absolutely sure you never, ever get lost, you know, because you must find this place, here's your Google map, go here. It's a way of mastering a place without getting lost in it, and to that extent not experiencing it, because you are following out a preordained program or itinerary rather than exposing yourself to the culture you find yourself in. So that for me is an analogy to what I'm talking about. It's not having an idea of the place you're going to in advance. Oh, you know, I've got an idea of going to visit, you know, the ruins at Pompeii. Or, you know, I've got the idea of going to Machu Picchu because, I've got a picture of that and I want to now make that idea real. Really good exploration or good adventure, and I mean, you know, culturally, but also personally, should be about not having the idea. It should be about being open to what's not formed as an idea in the first place, but allows you to get lost in it. And again, certainly the work I do with artists, this seems to come up again and again. There has to be a place of real stuckness, lostness, before you can come out again. Because unless you're truly lost, unless you truly feel resourceless at some point in that process, you are not empty enough to receive. You know, if you keep yourself topped up with ideas all the time, you never become open enough to get the sustenance you require in order to move on. You'll just end up recycling what's already out there, what's already in the zeitgeist. So the idea of getting stuck, getting lost, not knowing the way forward, being radically uncertain, seem to me, all of those I gather under the umbrella term of perdition, seem to me to be an essential precondition for moving forward. But we get scared of it, because we want ideas, and ideas become our signal, kind of through the forest, as it were, on our way out. So anyway, it's just a few pointers as to what I'm talking to. The limits of ideas, you know, the ideas are, first point, I wonder about the value of ideas in the spiritual life and their connection with the soul. Does the soul need ideas? Ideas aren't real. Then these different ways of seeing. We mediate the world a lot through ideas, and it stops us from being able to take on board what is. Then we have this notion of the solus as a kind of creative spring, which is non-ideas based, really. And finally, the idea of perdition, kind of getting lost, kind of radically lost, in a way that we're not being navigated by an idea of where to go. So there you go, some ideas on why ideas are not so great. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. I've got plenty of questions, but I want to just briefly connect with the audience for a second. Can I have any thoughts anyone really feel they want to share at this moment? Just and keep them relatively brief if you can, but just to get a sense of where the audience is after that.
You're talking about ideas, thoughts, logic. They don't have drop of reality in them, really. My idea is that reality is very hard to bear. I don't know about, maybe you're referring to Anthony Storr for with solitude, but what I'm thinking is, I like the idea by Plato, is that there is a lot of nothingness and hidden aspects, and perhaps the curiosity to go and pursue them.
Thank you. It's a very rich question with a lot of cognitive content, so which is appreciated, but I'm looking for a slightly more visceral response from someone.
I feel it all depends on my energy level and how buoyant I am on the given day. And then I interact and I have a totally different experience. And those days are very rare, but when they happen, they're miraculous.
Thank you. Anyone else?
A lot of people go to the theatre because they read reviews before they go, and they will only go to something that they have read a review about. I never read reviews before I go to the theatre because I like to get lost in the play. And I think that's a bit of the perdition thing. So then I experience the play from a base of zero.
Thank you very much. We have a gentleman here in the corner, and then two behind, and then one here, and then we'll stop there.
My thought is you've outlined several different ways of seeing, but there was one not mentioned, particularly, I think, with creative people, artists, and that's the use of mind-altering substances and how that fits in.
You mentioned the idea of ideas being a weather vane of, you know, trying to, you know, we're lost, where to go next, and what you said really correlates with something, you know, Steve Jobs and the like say, which is that actually you join the dots backwards. So you just go with your life, and then you find out, actually, in hindsight, something else you mentioned as well, where what you've been through has taken you.
What I was thinking about the perdition that you talked about, it's in my experience, it's when you're truly lost and truly resourceless, and you think that's the end of the world, then suddenly you find the courage. And yeah, that's why I wanted to say the courage suddenly appears to go and that you thought you didn't have.
So I just wanted to get that stock tick because, Robert, you mentioned that we often wait for big ideas to rescue us. So to give it just a brief bit of context for this event. So in addition to the spirituality report, I also do a lot of work on climate change here. And if ever there is a sort of world planetary issue where we feel like we need ideas, or at least the prevailing narrative is that we need ideas, it's that one. It's a sense in which we're going to get rescued somehow by either a technological innovation or a creative approach to behavior change or a particular way of lobbying government. But the idea is that somehow something will come from stage left, crystallize what needs to be done, and the problem will be solved. But my own take increasingly on working on climate change over 2 or 3 years is that the resources we need are much more somatic, emotional, intuitive. They're much more about feeling the problem inside ourselves, about allowing yourself to cry about it, about getting angry about it, about sort of, you know, sensing what's not working and why. And that form of inquiry actually is not really permitted, really, in most contexts. It's not considered valid knowledge. So I guess the first question for you is, insofar as that's the case, how do you give validity to these forms of inquiry? How do you go about trying to? And just a little bit of context for that question. You're quite lucky because you've walked the talk of ideas. You've sort of earned your stripes. You know, Robert was an All Souls Fellow. You know, he's written books. He has complete intellectual self-confidence, doesn't have any worry about the world of ideas. But I think it's fair to say not everyone's in quite the same space. So how do you go about making these non-forms of ideational inquiry valid in a way that makes sure it really is beyond ideas and not beneath them?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I mean, in relation to the specifics of climate change, I think it's, as you say, there is a kind of big idea about climate change that the climate is changing and that's big and scary. And there's a big idea that we ought to do something about it. And they both kind of sit out there in the kind of stratosphere, almost literally in the stratosphere. And I think one way to kind of validate non-ideas-based approaches to that is to recognise that, in fact, a lot of the way we can make progress on those subjects is by working on the relationships between those people involved. Because from what I understand about the relationships between different entities involved, there's a lot of competition, there's a lot of rivalry, there's a lot of conflicting agendas. There's kind of entanglements between, in that network. And if one were to say, look, let's sort out the relationships here first, you don't therefore have to start talking about, you know, let's work in a non-cognitive way, non-ideational way, which would be a bit off-putting for some people. But you do start saying, let's work with what is. Let's work with the situation we find ourselves in. Let's recognise that the relationships among ourselves is itself part of the problem. So by bringing working on the relationships into view, you're dealing with what's real without having to go down the route of talking about the non-cognitive or non-ideational. And then you're working with, you know, the emotion in the room. It seems to me that is a non-threatening, reasonably valid way of going about things.
Okay, hold that thought. I don't want to respond to that. I don't want to feel that that's piquing any thoughts. The reason I ask is that what I'm thinking of there is meetings I have here at the RSA where you often sense certain feelings or intuitions that don't have currency. It's like you have to translate them into intellectual currency before they get heard. What you want to say is, I'm pissed off, or this is making no sense, or I feel this is deceptive somehow, deceitful somehow. Or you might say, this is joyous and wonderful, as it usually is here, by the way. But yeah, some response to that at the back there.
Alec Robertson, a fellow. I've just come from a Creative Industries Federation event with the Minister for Education, and it's all about arts, education in schools. And there's a lot of fear about it, which the Minister tried to reassure everybody about. I also read a little piece by Peter Murphy, who's Professor of Creative Arts and Social Aesthetics at James Cook University, Australia, and he wrote something called The Creativity Slump, Why the Arts and Sciences Are Fading, Failing and Deteriorating. And he proved the point in various statistics that the big steps are not being made now that were made before. And there's a connection there in that the arts and sciences became separated compared to many of the big steps that were made earlier. I don't know whether this relates to what directly to the topic, but I think the relationship between the artists and the scientists has gone wrong, and the individuals, but also in the institutions, and that's causing lack of creativity.
Okay, let's take that question. It's quite a big one.
That's very interesting. And this division, I'll just pick up on one aspect of it, because you referred to a lot there, and it's a very rich question. But this division between arts and sciences, which, you know, is now entrenched, in our culture. And I think that does, one of the effects of that is that, you know, artists think, have an idea of what it is to be an artist, just as scientists have an idea of what it is to be a scientist. Artists think they have to be creative all the time. Our scientists think they have to be kind of empirical all the time. Whereas, in fact, it's exactly in that crossover between the two that you'll get the most interesting work. And, in fact, if you talk to the real leading scientists, they're the ones who are most open, in fact, to different forms of thinking, to, you know, the place of intuition, to gut feeling, to the arts, and so on. And likewise, if you talk to some of the kind of leading artists these days, they're the ones doing kind of research as well on molecular structures in photographs and so on. I mean, it's precisely the integration of the two that seems to me the way forward if we want to, you know, allow for, you know, creativity. Not that creativity is always the answer to everything. But I think it bears out this point, you know, that having an idea of what it is to be an artist is probably the last thing you want to have if you want to be an artist.
Hi there. Just to your point, Pedram, I'm also a fellow. To your point around emotions and, you know, just calling them out in meetings and stuff. And you mentioned gut feeling as well. That from my limited understanding of sort of gut feelings, etc., that comes from the limbic system part of your brain. I don't know if that's a too sort of basic way of saying that, but it's the interpretation of those intuitions or that gut feeling that I think people maybe feel wary of expressing, which perhaps limits people's openness to be able to go beyond ideas into kind of the experience of.
Thanks. And to Dan, thanks.
I think part of it is possibly we've done ourselves a disservice. In some ecosystems, certain people have been labelled the creatives. And I'm thinking particularly in the agency context, from a sort of creative industry working with business, that the creative team have sort of created this whole aura around themselves because they call themselves the creative team, yet you've got people in the business who are absolutely creative, but sort of it's not in their job description. So it sort of limits that creativity because of that.
What I found in the world of ideas, working at the RSA, when you actually encourage people or invite them to do forms of inquiry that aren't altogether intellectual or rational, they lap it up. They're absolutely gagging for it. You know, my feeling is that people really, really want to explore this, but we haven't quite got over that barrier of making it legitimate. One example recently, just you mentioned constellations in passing, but it's a particularly good example, a form of inquiry called constellations inquiry, which Robert knows well and practices, where actually you get people in the room who may have expertise, but they're not really allowed to speak from it. Instead, they have to speak much more in terms of where they are in the position of the group. And can you say a little bit more about that and why that might help to illustrate this broader idea?
Yeah, so constellations is a practice. You bring a group of people together. Somebody in that group of, say, 20 people, somebody in that group has a challenge or a question or an issue. They explain that issue very briefly. That might be a personal issue, like, you know, relationship, sex issue, or money issue. It may be a job issue to do with, you know, being promoted, losing a job, or whatever it might be. And then from around the group, they will select various people to represent those characters they've just spoken about, okay? But it's not a role play at all. So, you know, if you are selected to represent somebody from this person's question, you are simply positioned in the room, physically positioned in relation to the others in the room, so that you get a physical 3D spatial dynamic, a map, essentially, of what's going on in that person's head. But then the people who are standing up don't know the person with the issue, so they bring no data, they have no expertise that they can apply. Nevertheless, just by virtue of being stood in that system, they begin to understand what it feels like, and they can report on that dynamic. They're able to bring alive those feelings, those intuitive senses of what's going on. And for me, that's a very good example of working with not necessarily different forms of seeing, but different forms of knowing. Because we can know things, even about the unconscious of people we've never met, just by virtue of being positioned in their system in some way. So, and this is available to all of us. You know, it happens all the time. I've run hundreds and hundreds of constellations, been in loads. And
just to clarify, you've done it with reputable, I mean, not just with us, but you've done it with various other well-known names.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's not fringe activity.
It's not fringe activity. But, yeah, exactly. I mean, the point is that we, you know, what I'm talking about might sound like it's, you know, you require sort of ninja skills in order to be able to get to the level of it. It's not the case at all. It's available to all of us. We're all capable of a kind of deep knowing of the systems that we are in and of other people's systems as well. But what generally interrupts or inhibits that deep knowing is that we have too many ideas. We arrive with too many projections, too many assumptions about what's going on. And that is the biggest limitation for us.
I'm a psychotherapist as well. And I think what you're touching on there is empathy. And the problem is the relationship between the ego and our ability to experience directly relationships with people. And ideas service the ego. So I think there's perhaps more that you could say about that.
Before you do, you mentioned at the end of your talk this sort of fourth quality of knowing that sounded quite mystical. I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, but just it sounds as though ideas come through you, you know, from within you, from outside the world. How should we understand that? Are you saying we don't quite know why it is the way it is? It just happens to be that these ideas come? Or are you giving a deeper interpretation that somehow, I don't know, there is a collective unconscious or there is some other way of explaining what's going on?
Well, I mean, I guess in very simple terms, I think ours is a culture that believes in making things happen rather than letting things happen. And our ability to let things happen and to pick up data from what happens to us is relatively limited. And that when we put ourselves in the position of letting things happen, we can often find that we get taken to places we wouldn't always get taken to when we make things happen. Because you know, agency, ambition, drive, purpose, or these are all Western virtues. And that, you know, there's nothing wrong with any of those. I'm not, you know, critiquing those. But the trouble is we become very right-handed. We just use that hand all the time. You know, we become like, you know, Rafa Nadal. We've got a big muscly right hand. And the other one is, you know, still, you know, relatively weak. And I'm talking about kind of strengthening this other side to us, which is about kind of letting things come and the knowledge that can arise when we let things come rather than precipitously try and seize the world in front of us and make things happen.
So I don't know how everyone else feels, but when I hear that, I think, yeah, that makes sense, and I want to do more of that. On the other hand, I can't help but be curious about the explanation for these forms of letting things happen. My mind wants to fill the vacuum there that says, how does that happen? Where is it coming from? Is that a problem? Is it something I should do less of? How would you explain
well,
that?
You're turning letting it happen to making it happen, aren't you? How can I make letting it happen happen?
But that's an instinct, I think it's fair to say, it's probably not mine alone.
And, no, absolutely.
And have you come across that? How would you encourage people not to do it? Because, like I say, I feel as though you've sort of, you've developed into a place where you can do that. You've sort of exhausted ideas to some extent, still value them, are very nimble and fluent in them. But I feel for many other people, there's still a sense in which we have to sort of scale the ideas Olympus before we can get to this point of tranquility. Or is that not what's going on?
I think it's, I mean, your point about what it's like here at the RSA is interesting, you know. Because I think, you know, the cultures we live in set the tone for this. You know, we've got to create frameworks in which we can let this happen. So I think, you know, leaders in organisations have a big part to play, not just in organisations, but in, you know, of larger kind of systems and movements and so on. So anybody in the room who's in a kind of leadership position has the authority within their own empire, whether small or large, to set the tone and to say, you know, we welcome things in this organisation that aren't just about ideas and brainstorming. You know, we welcome other forms of knowledge. We want to hear what your gut instinct is about this stuff. You know, we just want to hear. You know, if you've got an intuition that we shouldn't be doing this piece of work, or the client is really unhappy, or this project's going to go south, tell us.
But then what happens is they say, but and why do you feel that way? They immediately want the intellectual explanation, right?
Right.
So I suppose that's a good start, but you'd need something else to keep that rolling. There's a question just over here.
Yeah.
Thank you. Just an observation. I'm very interested in this emergent process that you seem to have trouble. Like there's a desire to find out what that thing might be that ideas would come from. Complex dynamic systems are spontaneously creative. That's how evolution works. It's change happens as a result of any system which is complex enough and dynamic will change its form and bits will emerge and stuff will just happen to happen. Being present to identify what is emerging is a source of your creativity, really.
It's something about a deeper grasp of reality in that sense.
And that's quite robust scientifically, and certainly in artistic practice, I think, artists work all the time, layering up till they've created something complex enough to begin to sort of spontaneously generate ideas for them.
Thank you. I wondered if you could say more about the linking of ideas and practices, because I work in the field of healthcare and management, and I'm interested in the flow of management ideas. And often that can be seen as both beneficial and pernicious, in that you have different people selling ideas for your next fad or fashion or solution. But actually, it's about how those ideas impact on practice, because there's loads of ideas circulating. And some of these can be very detrimental and some unproven, and some might be reported as success. And I think what I've got interested in, who's selling the idea. And that talks about power and credibility, and also I think touching on these things about why if someone comes up with an idea that it's somehow not valid or it's come from a different place. And I just wondered if you could maybe talk about the sources of ideas and how they link to practice and the consequences.
Good luck.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, that's a lot in that question, but your link between ideas and power is very important, I think, and the notion of who's selling an idea. So I think, you know, one question is, whose agenda does this idea serve? You know, it's always a good question to ask. Who benefits from this idea? Because ideas are often presented as though they're sort of ideologically neutral, but of course they never are. You know, they always serve somebody's interest. So I think it's always worth decoding that, you know, before getting into any notion of practice. You know, why are they sending me this idea? You know, whose ultimate benefit is this going to serve? I think that for me would be the way into it, and kind of unlocks the link to practice for me. You know, ideas are, you know, there's no accident that idea and ideological are connected as words. You know, they are. You know, they're always freighted with self-interest of some kind.
Hi there. Listening to you talk about sort of other routes to knowledge made me think of sort of William James's description of religious experiences as sort of being ineffable, like noetic. You have a sort of a sense of having some sort of direct access to knowledge, but you can't. It's not something you can articulate in words, but also being passive. And as you say, it's sort of the truth sort of emerging from you're sort of the receptacle or the sort of conduit. I wondered what sort of methods or practices you were interested in helping people access these other routes. And for example, I was thinking of particularly like contemplative practices, like sort of meditation or mindfulness, if you thought they had use.
Okay, thank you. Mm. Yes, the William James quote is very apposite, I think. However, I'm a little bit reluctant or resistant to talk about the ineffable and the mystical and so on. And the reason I do that really goes back to your question, because if I were to say this is all very ineffable and out of reach and enigmatic, well, what would the purpose of that be? It would be to set me up as some kind of demagogue. Like, I have access to this. Okay, you guys, you know, you're mere initiates, and I am the high priest of different ways of knowing, right? So although I could talk about, you know, the ineffability of these things, the ideological benefit would accrue to me because I would appear like the master of this. And, of course, there's no point in doing that because all it really does is establish a hierarchy. So I'm reluctant to talk about ineffability or the kind of the topos of ineffability. But I would say, you know, there are clearly links with varieties of religious experience. And, you know, meditation is clearly a way into this. What I've talked about in terms of constellations are clearly a way into this. But very ordinary things. I think gardening is a way into this. You know, physical labour, I think, is probably... I think if you want to root to different ways of knowledge, hard work is the best way to do it. You know, physical work is a very good way to do it. It doesn't, you know, the more you strain after a sort of a transcendent idea of other ways of knowing, the more you'll end up with a transcendent idea, you know, which isn't another way of knowing.
So in short, my question is, how do you sell your idea about going beyond ideas quickly? Because I run creative workshops, and what happens is that people want to do the right arm thinking first and then move to left arm. And I think that creates problems in the workshop. And what should be happening is we start with the left arm and then move to the right arm, because once the right arm gets going, there's no stopping it. You can pretend stop it, but you can't really. And so I was just wondering, how do you sell? Because right now you have a very receptive audience. But have you had any success in selling this idea quickly to a world that's bound to ideas?
Very quickly, I'm just wondering where the body is in all of this. Because even when we've used words like somatic or gut instinct, what I've heard is that one removed from that. So a gut instinct is actually an idea about something, as opposed to the actual raw data of our physical experience, which we often don't have language for and don't feel comfortable expressing.
Great, thank you for that. Okay, Robert, up to you to round off with those two questions in mind.
Okay, never start on that arm. Always start on the arm you want to get to. Always never go there, because I've tried that. You know, tried moving people from one arm to the other, and by that time it's too late.
By arms, because we can conflate this with brain hemispheres and stuff.
Exactly.
But we're, broadly speaking, without getting into the nitty-gritty, you're speaking about how do you go from the intuitive to the rational, or the implicit to the explicit, and which should you begin with, and why, right?
Right, okay. If you want to move people from the ideas-based approach to beyond ideas, very simply speaking, you've got to not capitulate to the ideas space, even at the beginning of your workshops. You've got to take them straight in, you know, plunge in at the deep end and stay there, because there's no other way to do it. Yeah, and you've just got to hold your nerve. And your question
body.
Was about the body. And, well, no, we don't have a language for it because it's not linguistic.
but it's important.
Except that we can use words like, you know, I notice a tightness in my body when I'm around this right. client and presenting work.
Absolutely. Right, okay, so in that sense, absolutely. So kind of direct reflection of, and the body is a much, the body never lies, you know, the body never lies. The body gives us direct information about the situation we're in much faster than the mind does, okay? And so if you play that back exactly as you said, then you're already, I think, in the right territory.
Okay, thank you very much, Robert. So I hope you've found your, or beginning to find your solace, that you get a little bit of perdition on the way home. And I want to thank you all very much for coming. Robert Littlesmith, thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.